Hello, my name is Mike Savage. I'm Professor of Sociology here at the LSC, and I convene a research team of the International Inequalities Institute around wealth and elites and tax justice. And I'm really thrilled to be chairing this event tonight. Fantastic evening ahead of us. Seamus Khan will need a very introduction to most people in this room. He's one of the most celebrated sociological ethnographers in the world. His study of privilege became an iconic study of elite education in the US. It's influenced lots of studies all over the world, and I've taught it so many times, and this always inspires students to think creatively about class, gender, race, eliteness, brilliance. But he's also got an amazing portfolio of work, methodological work around thinking about what you get from in-depth interviews such as ethnography, and the talk is cheap. It's again massively discussed amongst colleagues here at the LSC. He's done very important work on sexual consent more recently, and he's now turning, I think, to issues of eliteness in his new study. So it's going to be a really exciting presentation. I think he plans to speak for about 40 minutes. Lots of time, questions and discussion after that. So no further ado, Seamus. Thank you.
I want to thank the LSE for hosting such a wonderful event. Thank you so much, Liz, for just bringing this all together in such a beautiful way. And a special thanks to Annette also for convening us all here together, having such a creative idea for bringing a conference together. And I have to say, on a personal note, you probably saw some of this in her own talk. Annette has been just an amazing mentor to me in times where I've sort of said, like, what am I doing with my life? And wondering if I could keep fighting for R&Rs in 25 years. I was like, that just seems like a nightmare to me. Like, I'm just doing the same thing again and again. And so Annette has been wonderful in just sort of giving me advice on purpose and academia and how to think through it. And so it's very special to be invited here to be part of this conversation. So I want to talk to you about John. I want to talk to you about John Jacob Astor. John Jacob Astor was the son of a butcher and brewer in Germany. He was born in a town called Waldorf, in a place that's not yet Germany. For those of you, it may ring a bell, the Waldorf Astoria as a hotel that actually comes from him. As a teenager, when he was about 16 years old, he decided to come to London. And as he came to London, he went to work with his brother making musical instruments, primarily flutes. You can still to this day buy Astor flutes. I wouldn't call them renowned, but they're reasonably well-respected sets of flutes. And as he came to London, he lived in Drury Lane, which was an area known a little bit for plays and theater, a little bit for prostitution. And so you could imagine what a young man from rural Germany would have seen as he arrived there. Within 4 years, he leaves. And he jumps really on the first boat after the end of what the Americans call the Revolutionary War in order to try his luck in America. And it's said that he left so early that he left when it was like a really, really bad idea to go because the like ice was still frozen in the harbors of New York, and he actually ended up first in Baltimore before making his way to New York City, where his older brother, one of three brothers we'll hear about today, ran a butcher shop. And his older brother said, you should come to New York to make your fortune. So the story goes. In New York, he works in a variety of jobs. He works for his brother at first, he works as a delivery man, and eventually he'll work for a Quaker, George Brown, who helps him set himself up as a fur trader. Fur trade has been a major industry in the United States by this time for about 150 years. The primary people he's trading with are Native Americans in the North and trading to China, where the economy is booming and fur as a luxury good is incredibly desirable. Through the fur trade, and in particular his fur monopoly through the Midwest and with Midwestern tribes, Astor sets himself up as a very wealthy man, but certainly not as wealthy as he would become in the future. What he ends up doing is buying some property in New York, around where he used to live, and through that purchase of property, becomes, in effect, the richest person in the world. somewhat debatable, but probably the richest person in the world. And his story is one that's told of somebody who basically, in a Horatio Alger-esque way, pulls himself up by his bootstraps to move from the son of a butcher of one of 12 kids to London and then to New York to become exceptionally wealthy. So wealthy, in fact, that, when the Titanic sinks, his great-great-grandson is the richest person perhaps in the world, who happens to also be on the Titanic at the time. His son, that great-great-grandson's watch was just auctioned off as a watch that was found in the Titanic, and I believe it was sold for over $1 million as a reconstructed watch, simply because it had been in the Titanic. And there is a Lord Astor here in Britain, who is a descendant of John Jacob Astor, a family that moved here to Britain because these two brothers got into a fight. They married into an old but very poor aristocratic British family, and by doing so became members of the House of Lords. They're rather conservative. And so this is the story of John Jacob Astor and his trajectory in the world. Now, this is part of a broader project I'm doing. And the project is on more than just John Jacob Astor, about thinking about intergenerational mobility in the United States and intergenerational wealth persistence. And the way that I'm kind of crafting this account is not really by writing a biography of Astor and the Astor family, but by following five people: John Jacob, his son, that person's son's wife, his grandson, and that man's wife. So, and the story will run between 1790 and 2006. And I use them to think through what were the different conditions in New York society as this family traversed a series of, is Ashley still here?
Yeah.
It's Buck Ellison. Because I texted him the picture of your talk, and he was like, oh my God, what an honor. The photograph that she showed. Buck is a friend of mine. We've done a bunch of events together on Elites. So he's very excited. I apologize for the interjection. And the provisional title of this is Exceptional, thinking about American exceptionalism, how it is that families persist, but not so much in an aristocratic way. I want to use this story, this classic story, to... Basically, what I intend to do is retell it for you. And to retell it not in the way that I just did, which is the classic account of John Jacob Astor, but by instead centering family dynamics within his story and trajectory. And to show to you that the story that I just told is correct but inaccurate. And by correct, what I mean is that it's actually correct. Every single detail I gave you was correct, I think, I hope, in that. But that in focusing on John Jacob Astor within that story, I provided you with an inaccurate account of the trajectory of his life. And if we begin to center family dynamics more like profoundly in the story of his life, what we'll end up seeing is that many of these explanations that I gave you, or supposed explanations, don't really work for what happened to him. And what I'm going to suggest is that this is in part because the unit of analysis is most frequently the individual. I am going to preserve within this talk, and with my in the broader arguments that I make, a unit of analysis, a unit of observation as an individual, which is to say the sets of observations I make will be about individuals. But instead I'm going to try and embed my analysis in a family dynamic. And doing so, I think, fundamentally transforms how it is that we see this thing. In this talk, I'm working not just with this empirical material, but with Shay O'Brien's empirical material, who was a former doctoral student at Princeton, who constructed a network of Dallas elites for a period of time, and some of that work has started to come out already. I'm going to suggest that what we frequently think of as the necessary conditions of sociological knowledge about elites are in fact choices about how to operationalize observations and concepts, and the different operational choices could yield quite different observations in ways that aren't just like more interesting, but they're really consequential for the sense of arguments that we might end up making. So the point of my talk today is to provide you with a broader outline of the argument. I'm going to go over that argument in greater detail, to ask for a moment how we got here, curiosity, like in a kind of curious way, In the conversation today, I actually workshopped this paper today. So some of this, I think, I might even change a little bit. Then I'm going to retell the Astor story at every step and show you how we might interpret things differently if we use the family as a unit of analysis before speaking very briefly about the implications of this argument. As Mike suggested, this is very early work, and it's not that common that I give a talk on a first draft of a paper, but this is a first draft of a paper. So as you hear this, I would think of this less as like, I figured out a definitive account of a thing, and here's how I'm thinking through something, and I really welcome you to think through it with me and give me feedback on what resonates, what doesn't, what you think of as like, you know, the live parts of the ideas versus the parts of the ideas that might require some amendment. So let's go to the argument in greater detail. I think it's not surprising but to most of you to say that overwhelmingly elite studies are the studies of men. And I say, but see, there are a lot of exceptions to this, and some of these exceptions are sitting in this room right now. And the response to this sort of no, that elite studies is the study of men, is to say that this is just a necessary condition of knowledge or something, an unfortunate reality of situations. In other words, that men happen to be in positions of power, and elite studies are a study of power, and so therefore, men are central to elite analysis. A second response is like, we should just add women in, right? Like, so this is similar to a bunch of critiques that have been made in a wide range of areas in sociology, where it's like, why is this all about men? And they'll be like, well, let's just add a gender variable. And I'm going to argue that this is actually, both of these things are insufficient as a way for understanding our object of analysis, and that what we should do instead is think about shifting the unit of analysis away from the individual to the family. And one of the advantages of doing so is that families have a kind of inherent relationality. So the core problem, the study of elite studies is the study of men, is not that, like, you know, men don't have power. It's actually that often elite studies fundamentally fail to capture the relationality of elite dynamics and the relationality of social dynamics in general. And the family is an inherently relational concept that helps us sort of bake in this to our solution. Now, most people would say, like, this is true, but we have lots of examples of this already. And I'm going to go walk through two of them, network dynamics and organizational dynamics. And what I'll do as part of the argument is to show how some of those network dynamics are operational choices that actually center men in the ways that we want to measure things. And organizational dynamics actually do the same thing. So let me talk about the unfortunate necessities of, say, network data when trying to address this phenomenon. So here, the unfortunate necessity is like a quote that I attribute to no one because no one ever said it. But I think it's sort of a dynamic of what we might say in doing this kind of work, which is that network analysis constructs and operationalizes networks almost exclusively about men, but this is simply a necessary condition for the production of knowledge because researchers are interested in positions of power and men occupy positions of power. So this is simply a social fact and we have to deal with it. And I'm going to suggest, and I'll point to Shea's work here very briefly, that this is not a fact, it's a choice. And it's a choice about how we imagine what influence looks like. It's a choice about thinking about, like, if I'm going to look at network dynamics of a corporation, what I need to do is study corporate boards and not say who board members are married to. Why is this so important? I'm going to give you a bunch of historical examples of this. But let me quickly point to a contemporary example, which is Jamie Dimon, who is the CEO of Citi and an incredibly powerful and wealthy man, who, if you were to measure his connections on corporate boards, would be considerable. But if you built his wife into the equation, it would be so much more profound because she is from an enormously powerful family who brought with her in their marriage a series of things, ownership of oil companies, ownership of a range of cosmetic companies, ownership of a wide range of things under Baker Industries that, like, are not observable if we remove her from the analysis. And similar things could be said about other people and their children, which I won't speak to as much today. So the inherent assumption that influences and connections happen through positions men tend to occupy defines out of interest the sets of things that women might regularly do or bring to a family as a unit of analysis. And this is not an unfortunate necessity, but I'm going to say of focusing on power, but instead an artifact of research design and an artifact of research imagination about how it is that we think phenomena work. Other obvious necessities might look at something like organizations. And so in the study of organizations, you would say, I'm not really interested in men, I'm just interested in organizations. And men happen to be, say, CEOs of organizations. They end up hold the management positions of organizations. And so my interest is not de facto in men, but instead in the structure, composition, and action of organizations. And the obvious necessity when I do such a thing is to look at the men who are the major position takers within those organizations. Again, I'm going to suggest that these obvious necessities of data gathering are in fact operational choices about how to gather data, and they have huge influences. Women often don't hold official positions within organizations, and yet they wield considerable influence over organizations. I'll point to this concretely in the Aster case. Granted, it's going to be quite old in terms of data, like from a long time ago, but I could point to other ones, and I'm happy to in the present case. And attention to individuals as units of analysis, as position holders within organizations, tend to generate a series of consequences that I think help us get stories wrong, not right. So what does centering families do? It doesn't just mean adding women. I'm asking us to think for a moment to reorient ourselves about how we gather data, think about influences, trajectories, mobility, and even the concept of power. Something which Mike pointed to today that we need to integrate into our understanding of elite studies. It will place children at the center of elite dynamics, not just as recipients of status, which is how they tend to be understood, but instead also producers of status within a shared family project, right? So those of you here who are like students at the LSE, you might at some point tell family members like, oh, I'm at the LSE, and like maybe even family members brag about it a little bit, right? Like they say like, oh, my kid's at the LSE. And it comes because like you are a status worker in a shared family project, right? And it may be a weird way of thinking about yourself. It's not all that you are, but it's an important conceptualization and thinking about these kinds of ties that don't just work downwards, but they work upwards and that they have lateral influence is important. It'll help us see some gendered strategies of intergenerational persistence and exclusion. So to center the family is not just to center like including more people, it also means excluding a lot of things because families fundamentally are exclusive in really important ways. It'll help us see, I think, certain structural constraints under different time periods and understand lateral ties as well. So it's not a panacea. So it's not actually the greatest thing ever. As much as it seems like I'm super excited about it, gathering family data is incredibly labor intensive. The benefits of such data gathering are hugely limited. So in my corporate board example, it's really easy, not really easy, but it's relatively easy to construct population level data about corporate boards. It's really hard to make that part of a broader family network, and incomplete data may actually do more harm than good in helping us understand phenomenon. The scalability of gathering family is not that helpful, and I'll just know, like my main object I haven't even defined. Like, have I defined the family yet in this conversation? Not at all. And actually this unit of analysis family may be a different phenomenon in different times and different places. And so that would require us, like, if we were to do cross-national, cross-temporal accounts of family dynamics, but our unit of analysis fundamentally shifts in its definition across those different places, like, comparison may not really be that helpful of a tool. So there's going to be some problems, and you guys can help me think of a bunch of other problems. But nonetheless, I think it's useful to think this way. And I want us to ask for a moment, like, how did we get here? So how did we get to the point where families sort of aren't really part of elite analysis? And it actually is like really curious because I think most of us would know that like aristocracies, the sort of core feature of previous social structure of elites, were defined by families. Like, you can't even make sense of an aristocracy without making sense of a family. We know that marriages are frequently meticulously arranged. And I don't just mean that there's arranged marriages. I mean, everyone is sort of involved in the arrangement of marriages in important ways. And sociology is, of course, deeply interested in questions of mobility, trajectories, and social backgrounds. So, like, it may seem absurd that we don't take families into account. So let me deal with sort of each of these in turn. And first, this is the part of the talk that may change, to begin with the emergence of capitalism. And note that in the emergence of capitalism literature, here I'm going to talk both about Marx, Engels, and Weber, families are seen as an artifact of a previous structure of economic conditions under Marx. That's not the right sentence. Marx presents us with a stage-sequential model of economic development, and in his stage-sequential model of economic development, family as a form of accumulation is what he would refer to as a quote-unquote primitive form. And if you read what he says, it's here on the thing of about capitalist accumulation, what you do see is that he focuses primarily on the individual and the individual capitalist. Let me be very clear, I'm not making an argument that Marx was a methodological individualist. I'm also not suggesting that Marx thinks that capitalists determine the logic of capitalism. Capitalism itself determines its own logic, and capitalists are position takers. If they chose to act differently, they would be outperformed and they wouldn't be capitalists anymore. But nonetheless, he sort of thinks about capital and capitalists in highly individualistic terms. This is the second time we've seen MCM prime on the slide today, which is somewhat surreal to me because, like, Marxism is not a
old school, right?
Nice job, actually. And, you know, we could think, like, well, didn't Engels bring the family back into a central, like, Marxist analysis? And the answer is, like, no, he absolutely did not. What he did is that, like, we should think about the family. So there's the classic Marxian poster, you know, capitalist production or the production of labor relies on domestic labor. And when Engels brings the family back into analysis, he does so by maintaining that the family is a critical actor in social life, but epiphenomenal to economic relations. They maintain, basically, the fundamental account of economic relations being first, and families just being a secondary association with it. So they, in other words, families are not independent actors, but instead dependent on the social structural form, the economic form here. And they yield very little. They should be studied, but not in terms of their explanatory value. Weber's may be even worse than Marx in this regard, where he doesn't simply maintain the position, but he seems to amplify it, where he thinks of family dynamics as a primitive form of production. And in certain sets of arguments that he makes, he actually says that families resist the fundamental feature of capitalism, and the fundamental feature of capitalism is individualism. And so Weber argues that families' tendency to resist rationalization, actually he sees to a certain degree as like a benefit, like they help us like a little bit out of that iron cage. But overall, he thinks of them as putting the group before individuals and therefore putting some brakes on the advancement of certain logics of capitalism. Now, the removal of families from sociological theory of elites has clear historical. This is just a summary, so I'm going to skip it because I'm already 25 minutes in. But basically, epiphenomenal, primitive, or inconsistent with capitalist accumulation. And I think we see lingering implications of this today. But I'll just say that, like, the Farrell quote is the important one here, where basically there is an individualist orientation to social class that predates, like, that marks most of American sociology, with the pervasive belief of the decline of the family as an institution with macrostructural, political, and economic consequences. What about Bourdieu? This is just my one. I was like, I should add a slide on Bourdieu. And I'll just note that Bourdieu builds really strong patriarchal assumptions into his models about social position passed down from children to children. He almost says nothing about lateral ties or the status work that children do, and he says almost nothing about women and gender. Short of Masculine Domination, a very brief book that's like certainly not his best. He's generally not interested in the questions of families. And so while he's interested in the question of intergenerational reproduction, It's generally about how father's status gets transferred to children, and primarily male children. And so, as his own explanation, you might argue, well, as a theoretical concept, we can actually apply Bourdieu much more broadly. But if you're looking for an account of the family, you don't really get it in Bourdieu. Bachelor's Ball gives you something. The Algerians gives you a little bit, but it's like the way that it constructs sort of binary oppositions throughout that early ethnography is like, it doesn't really get you to the family either. So there is a movement, however, to think more seriously about the family. And some people in this room have been part of that. As the inheritance of wealth has once again become a central predictor of life's chances, scholars are beginning to bring family into the studies of wealth and power with a lot of empirical demonstrations of the importance of doing this. And so I think of this not as like me and Shay as like lone people, but part of a broader movement of thinking about the family within elite studies. And overall, I would say it changes an account. And here I just want to very briefly point to Shay O'Brien's work, where she takes on the classic assumption of a distinction between oil men and old elite in Dallas society. So in the United States, there's an iconic sense of like the new money oil men. And what she shows in, this is a piece in Socioeconomic Review, that like there are no new oil men. Like they're all married into elite Dallas families. And they're all, many of them are descended from elite Dallas families. And if they're not descended from elite Dallas families, they're descended from another elite family somewhere that's not in Dallas, and then they move to Dallas and marry somebody who's an elite Dallas person. Of her map of the Dallas upper class, which includes 70,000 people, I mean, it does not include 70,000. It's totally false. I apologize. What she's able to show, though, is that, like, there is not a set of families in Dallas. 73% of Dallas upper society, sort of from kind of the equivalent of a who's who, are intermarried to one another. This is a dense, dense family web, and Shay is able to show the enormous importance of basically like all of these concepts of new elite are old elites that disappear in part because of an account of this family web. I'm not gonna focus on that. Instead, I'm going to focus on the Astor story and bring you back to the historical account I began with. The project that I'm working on is an attempt to sort of do what I describe as a historical ethnography, so to sort of try and use a little bit of history and tell stories about individuals and how they traverse their day-to-day lives. The data from this are based upon looking at the Astor papers, which is a series of papers from the Astor family that are located within three different archives. The two primary ones I draw upon are the New York Public Library and the New York Historical Society. Astor family, John Jacob Astor was engaged in almost no philanthropy his entire life until he died. When he died, he gave what became known as the Astor Library, which was a library on Lafayette Street in New York City that held in part some of the family papers, but he insisted that the library, unlike most libraries, stay open until 9 p.m. so the working men of New York City could go and better themselves by educating themselves in a library, get access to things like books and newspapers. It was not a successful library because Astor owned New York, and so all the working men didn't particularly like Astor because he was their landlord. And so visiting like your landlord's library wasn't like a thing that people wanted to do. And the Astor Library subsequently closed and reopened as New York Public Library. So the New York Public Library on 42nd and 5th, you know, was built basically by four families, but primarily by Astor. And it was not called the Astor Library, it was called the New York Public Library very purposefully, and it was built on land that John Jacob Astor's family gave to the city of New York for the purposes of building that library, and the family's archives, along with the Tilden family and two other families, are located there within it. So that's one of the major places where it is, and then the other is in the New York Historical Society. I'll just note that it's ironic that the Astor family chose not to name the library after themselves, but instead to make it an unnamed library. But recently, in 2011, Stephen A. Schwarzman donated $100 million to have the library named after himself. So this is just, you know, kind of a curious artifact. So let's retell this story of John Jacob Astor, and let me just remind you of the steps along the way. As a teenager, he travels to England, where he manufactures and sells flutes. He then goes to America for opportunity to work with his brother. He works in a variety of tasks, butcher, trader, fur trader, etc. He sets up his fortune through the fur trade primarily, and then in owning a non-trivial portion of Manhattan, he would be able to sustain the family for generations. They were kind of lucky that they didn't have a trust and they had land, and they had land in an area that was very valuable. Okay, so John Jacob moves from Germany to London to seek his fortune. He's a very ambitious person. This turns out not really to be the case, and Annette asked for a little bit more detail as to why he was forced to leave his hometown. He lived in a small town, and there really wasn't enough for him to like set up his own business. He tried to set up his own business. He applied for a permit. He was turned down by the local council. Sitting on the local council was his father, who basically shut down his capacity to open up what might have been something competing. Why did he apply? Because his older brother was running the butchery, and to a degree, it's late and I just landed in England, so the pub, basically, like that the family owned. And so he was driven out of town, and because his older brother was a much better worker, basically. And he had another older brother who was like, it's really hard for me to find good labor in London. Can you send somebody over? So he goes to London because he's not very good at his job. His brother, his older brother, and his dad try to protect their basic economic interest. And his other older brother is like, I need somebody to work for me. And also, they didn't really speak English. So, and you'll see this, I'll show you his writing in a little bit. It was helpful at the time. So he moves from Germany to London, not to seek his fortune, as it might say, but instead because of a range of family dynamics that he was experiencing at the time that drove him away. Then he moves from London to New York. And you might think, he goes to New York to seek his fortune. Again, this isn't really the case. As it turned out, he spent 4 years in London. He learned minimal English, like his English was okay by the time he left, but he's not particularly useful for his brother. He's not a good flute maker. And he doesn't really speak English that well, so he's not good at selling the flutes either. And so he ends up being kind of like just a cost rather than a benefit to his brother there. And we need to remember like that New York in 1780 was not a thriving city. It had 12,000 people. London had 1 million. And not only did it have 12,000 people, but like a large portion of New York had been burned during the Revolutionary War. The occupying British forces chose not to rebuild it, and a lot of people in New York left with Britain, and particularly a lot of Black Americans left with Britain, because Britain had promised freedom to Black Americans, which the New Republic was not promising to them, and so a lot of Black Americans had moved to New York. In the 1720s, about like almost a third of the New York population were slaves, so New York was the largest slave city in the early part of the 18th century. And then many moved either to England or they kind of dropped them off in Canada on the way back. And the governor Clinton, who held the first legislative session in New York, described the city as being on the ruins of a once flourishing city. And describing it as flourishing is a little flattering. Henry Astor would tell his brother George, that is the flute maker, that it was an easy place to set up because there wasn't that much competition. And this appealed to John Jacob. So like, if you thought of him as someone who was like he was kind of looking for an easier out. Maybe this is the idea of thinking about opportunity, but New York really wouldn't be the place you'd want to go for opportunity at the time. Like there were many other places you might want to go. And again, his older brother, who ran a butcher shop in New York, needed more labor because there was such an absence of labor supply in the post-Revolutionary War period. And his other brother was happy to get rid of him in London, right? And so he gets shuttled off at the age of 20 to New York. What I want you to take a step back from for a moment is just to think like the story of this guy having ambition driving him to London and then ambition driving him to New York in order to construct a meticulous fortune is very easy if you look at retrospective accounts and you know that he's really successful. But if you look to see like what actually happened, like if you look to find the permit that he applied to that gets denied in his town for establishing a commercial enterprise, you begin to see that there's a second set of family dynamics that's actually shuttling him and his trajectory in a way that was otherwise unobservable.
So,
John Jacob starts off in New York City and eventually starts his own business. This is how he becomes really wealthy. So he's under the employ of Robert Brown. I think I got that wrong name right. Bone, excuse me. I always did say Brown. And in his early career, Astor actually was quite useful to Bone because he had worked as a butcher in his father's shop, and he was really good at dealing with hides. And so in being able to deal with hides from his butchery practice, he was pretty useful overall in terms of the hide packing, like treating them, packing them in bales, and pulling ticks out of them and other sorts of things. And Bone was pretty old when he hired Astor, and he saw in him a relatively, like, spry, enterprising young man, which didn't really reflect what his brothers seemed to think of him, and sent him outside of the city to trade. And so here, Astor is given a hatchet, a set of provisions, and beads, tobacco, and cloth to trade with native peoples in order to sort of get furs from them. Now, Native Americans had been doing this trade for over 150 years and were extremely savvy at it. And actually, one of the skills that's clearly the case for Astor was his ability to do this sort of trading. In the talk that I'm going to give on Monday, I'll talk a little bit about sort of placing elites within a global web of both local and international dynamics, that is, thinking both about how it is that Astor is dealing with the native people, but then also making his fortune through the China trade, which is really how most Americans made money at this time, was through export. About 90% of GDP was international trade for the United States in its early founding. But how did he really get a start? The story of Robert Bone is like kind of accurate, but it's not really very accurate. What really happened is that he married Sarah Todd. Now, who was Sarah Todd? Sarah Todd, as a mother, who's also named Sarah Todd, so I apologize for the confusion, and for some reason we don't have like Sarah Todd Jr. as women's names, but I'm gonna call them Junior and Senior. Sarah Todd Senior married a Scottish emigre who ran a series of vessels that traveled around the West Indies. And so as you might imagine, there is slave money here. One of the things that Sarah Todd's father did was engage in shipping in the West Indies, which was both sugar and slave shipping. And they were a pretty well-established family until he died. They made two critical mistakes in their life. The first was, I'll just talk about one of them. He owned about four merchant ships, which is a lot of merchant ships at the time, and he sold them because the war was starting and he knew he wasn't going to be able to do any merchant trade with the British or the Americans. And so he then bought bonds, basically, from the future U.S. government that all ended up being worthless. But they had enough money to sort of maintain, as we'll see in a moment, a certain standard of living, but they had to have some, they like had boarders in their relatively large house. They also married into the Brevoort family, which was one of the wealthiest families in New York City. And they were particularly connected with merchants, the Brevoort family, that's what they did. And they had a deep interest in land purchasing in Manhattan, which will become very important for John Jacob Astor in the future. The Todd family came, Sarah Todd, with $300 as a dowry for her marriage. To give you some context for this, this is about five times the average yearly salary for a New Yorker. So it's a non-trivial amount of money, and Astor sets up his business in the family house where Sarah and her mother work in the business, and they're crucial to the success of the business. So too are the shipping connections that the Brevoort family bring to them and the insight into real estate buying as a way to hedge a series of problems with wealth. Astor, throughout his business trajectory, has many, many shocks to his business where he nearly goes bankrupt. Sarah Todd Sr. was central to advising him to make sure that he diversified his portfolio because her husband, in having a singular set of investments, went basically broke or very close to broke. So here, a set of family information really matters. I'll also just note one thing that, like, it's interesting to me that business historians who've written about Astor before never asked one question. Much of the business history of John Jacob Astor is about him wandering up through to Montreal, traveling to England, around trading with tribes, et cetera, and then talking about how successful the family business in New York is. One question that doesn't get asked is, if John Jacob Astor is traveling in the Midwest trading with tribes, who's running the business? Like, it's not like there was a postal service in the 1790s that could ferry letters back and forth quickly between, say, Detroit and New York City. It would take 6 weeks. So who is running the shop? As it turns out, it's Sarah Todd. And I'll just give you one piece of interesting sort of like information here about this, where in 1788, the shop has this thing that it puts out, a sentence, and it says, the business gives cash for all kinds of furs and has a sale of quantity of Canada furs, which has beaver, beaver coating, raccoon skins, raccoon blankets, and spring musk, rat skins, which he sells by large and small quantities. A considerable allowance will be made to every person who buys a quantity. What they say they do. 1795, a little bit later, this is a letter that John Jacob Astor wrote to Peter Smith when he was worried about losing his business. Business here very much deranged, so that I shall, am afraid, fall short of cash. Even to comply with my estrangements, you would much oblige me to send. Even years later, he was mocked for his inability to spell and his terrible sentence structure. And like, you can see it here for a moment. Now, my point is not to make fun of John Jacob Astor for not speaking English. He's a German emigre who, like, lived in an English context and was moderately literate. It's just to note that, like, if you looked at the bookkeeping of the business, it was clear that the person who was doing a lot of the work was a native-born literate English speaker. Now, John Jacob could have been, I can't say, like, he wasn't directing his wife in how to run this business. But I can say to you that, like, this to me strikes me as some evidence that she was very much involved in the everyday business of it. And as my little, you know, historical ethnographic account of trying to figure out where he was at every period of time noted, he often wasn't there. Years later, after he had made huge amounts of money, wasn't really running the shop anymore, they were relying on basically dividends from their land, Europeans came to visit the Astor household, one of the largest homes in New York, and they marveled at two things. First, that John Jacob Astor ate his peas with a knife. So a British aristocrat went back and was like, I've just seen the richest man in the world eating his peas with a knife. Kind of horror at this. And the second thing was that he saw Astor have this joking moment with his wife, who was known to be one of the best judges of the quality of fur and what to charge for them. And they broke out furs and asked her, Sarah Todd, to value them, and she did. And it was noted that John Jacob Astor, as his philanthropy, used to pay his wife $500 an hour in those days, so that she could use the money to support her charities, for her to judge furs. And this was like a party trick that they did, apparently. I want to note that, like, this isn't just a story of John Jacob Astor, but in fact, very common for the new men of New York. So Albert Gallatin, probably one of the most important New Yorkers when it comes to finance, the Treasury Secretary for the four of the first five presidents, was seen as a new man who came to New York and, like, you know, made a fortune and made American fiscal policy in an enormous way. I picked these three people because they're part of a business history book called Founders in Finance, three men who restructured American society around finance. They're all new men. So the story of the book is basically they're men who moved to New York to make a fortune, and they're not like the landed gentry of New York. And unnoted in that book is who they were married to. So Gallatin is married to a colonel, a daughter of a colonel from the Navy, and one of the most influential families in Maryland, which is one of the most powerful states at the time. Alexander Hamilton, probably a story better known because of the, you know, married into one of the most established New York families. You know, he was an aspiring person, and I keep asking, like, why do any of these women marry these men? I guess a good man is hard to find. Shay has a hypothesis that actually, like, for larger families, sometimes marrying, like, seemingly quite talented men helps those families control those men much more. That a man from a very powerful family is actually pretty hard to control, but a man from one of these families is a little bit easier to constrain. I was like, that seems like a good account, but it doesn't work out if you know anything about Hamilton's sexual life. which is that, you know, he may have been involved with Elizabeth's sister as well. But the Schiller family is one of the most powerful families in New York at the time. Her father was a colonial baronet. Her mother was a Van Rensselaer, who were the largest landowners in New York through much of the 17th and 18th century. And then Stephen Girard, who was the wealthiest person in the United States for a long time, based in Philadelphia, a little less known, French emigre, made his fortune in part because of his marriage to a wealthy Philadelphia shipbuilder. And so I'll just note that many of the accounts of these, like, new businessmen who come to America as immigrants and make it and restructure America, it looks like an account of new men. But if we take at least the three archetypical examples that are provided in business history, or in my particular history of Astor, we see that they actually do something quite different. So, what are the conclusions here? I don't have many. Other than to say, what I've hoped to show today through this is that, like, there's a classic story of a person and a wealthy person and how they end up where they are. And all I've really done is, like, socialize that story. So I've turned it from a story of an individual into a story of someone embedded in a series of social relations. In the broader book, I'm really interested in how family dynamics work. So the book follows John Jacob Astor, his second son, Willem Backhaus Astor, his second son's son's wife, Carolyn Astor. So there are two women that structure the chapters. Vincent Astor, her grandson, that is the son of the person who dies in the Titanic, and then Vincent Astor's wife, Carolyn Astor. And those five people get me from 1790 to 2006. And so there's an aspect of the design for me that sort of centers family and family dynamics and, you know, seeing young people and then seeing them as adults and then seeing them as old people as the chapters move forward. But I want to ask, like, if you think about the core unit, not as the individual, but as the family, how do we conceptualize interest? That is, like, what an interest is. And I think that we can think about, like, people's family projects as central to their interest, and then people's actions within their families as central to their interests, where people might have multiple competing sets of interests based upon the interest of the family and the interest of themselves within it. Here, I think of, like, the family as a shared status project, where status work is sort of central to what members are doing. I hope you've shown that some claims about what trajectories look like are at least unstable, and in my view, pretty inaccurate. And that there's a value in the sort of relational embedding that happens when you take the family seriously. I'm hoping to show that you can add in gender without tacking on women, that is to make them part of sort of an equal part of the analytic structure of your thing. And maybe we might generate new understandings of mobility and persistence. I'm not sure yet. I'm still very much in the writing process. So I went a little over. I apologize, but thank you very much.
Thank you so much. James, do you want to sit down for
the
questions?
Or stand. Buck wants to know if he can put the picture on his Instagram.
Okay, thank you so much.
That was really close, Michelle.
Up to 40 minutes for questions.
We don't have to go for 40 minutes.
Please, if you wouldn't mind saying who, you know, your affiliation, your name, when you introduce yourself, or perhaps try and collect two or three questions. So, move some bits of questions. Who would like to... Everyone's wowed, you know?
Hi. Yeah. Please. Thanks very much for the sharing, and it just reminds me of every...
Name and affiliation.
Oh, yeah, thank you. My name is Ying Tam. I'm a PhD student at the University of Essex, Year 3, writing theaters.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, thanks for the presentation. It inspires me about the kind of like an extreme case in Korea. Maybe you heard about, like, Chaebol economy. So it's kind of, again, the enlarged family size and controlling, I mean, even then, only the capacity to control the whole country. So I mean, maybe, is it another case, maybe has some reflection from the case you mentioned?
I mean, I don't have reflections on it because I just, it's my information is so limited. I mean, I'll note that, like, this is not that surprising of a story. There are entire journals in management dedicated to family firms. And, like, you know, Luna's done a bunch of work on family firms. Like, we have people here who've done this kind of thing. It just isn't integrated as a central part of understanding elites, in part because it's seen as, like, a curious artifact, right? Like there's a little bit of an asterisk on it. Like, it's not like the normal processes. And what I'm suggesting is, like, that could be true. Like, family firms might be different. But, like, within normal firms, looking at these dynamics still can be really fruitful for generating new empirical observations. And so, you know, I wouldn't want to suggest that, like, this is super new because, you know, that, I forget what it's called, like, the Journal of the Family Firm? I forget the name of the journal. I'm pretty sure that's what it is. It's not like an impact factor of 7. Like, it's not like some little side journal. Granted, impact factors in these school journals are higher, but it's like a major part of the management conversation. And so, like, a different version of this talk is, like, how do we migrate over some of the core management insights that are about thinking about family and family dynamics as central to firms. And then I'll also note that, like, a lot of the family firm discussions happen, so in the broader paper, I sort of try to situate a little bit of this, like, there are discussions of, like, small firms in small towns in, like, out-of-the-way places in, like, Italy or southern France or Spain, or, like, they're not seen as sort of central to the general story. And what I'm suggesting is that that might be a mistake.
Okay, thank you. Any more comments?
Howdy, Benjamin Adams, LSC Department of Methodology. I can appreciate your hesitancy towards social network methods.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to see how you could use, say, a bipartite network to think about the wife's family as well as the husband's family, but
mm-hmm.
the fact of the matter is, oftentimes, historiographically, we just don't got the data.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking about other alternative relational approaches, Andrew Abbott's work comes immediately to mind,
mm-hmm.
especially his things of boundaries, and I suppose that leads me into a tentative question, which is, how is it that John Jacob Astor was able to center himself as the person of the story? And if this is a common theme among these accounts, how is it that males, men of means, new men, are able to become the heroes of this? What kind of boundary work is being performed to create these kinds of stories when the material interests are different?
Yeah, so, I mean, one of the things that happens is, like, just looking at the political and legal infrastructure. So, like, if you have rules about business ownership and, you know, you can't have women as officers of corporations for long periods of time, it doesn't mean they don't do work in it. It just means they don't appear on records. And one of the things I was pointing to is, like, you know, you can't have information about people on boards. Like, that's not true. You can. It just would be an enormous undertaking to do it. Right? So I would, you know, like, marriage records are actually public, right? So we can gather a lot of information on people's marriages, actually, even through scraping techniques. It's just that we kind of choose not to. And I would say that, like, a lot of the knowledge that's produced in these places, this is where the gender story comes in. And part of our conversation was, like, today in the workshop is, like, how much of this is a gender paper? How much of this is a family paper? I would be like, I think that the people who gather the data just think that women are irrelevant. They're just, like, they're not part of the story. They're, like, there as wives, but not as, like, equivalent people. And they make operational choices about how they conceptualize their object, right? And that's just, like, it's a research choice. I'm making research choices that also have consequences. So, you know, I'm not saying that, like, mine is perfect, but I would push back a little bit. I hope I answered the first part. Like, how are men able to center themselves? Like, well, if you can only be the owner of a business if you're a man, right? If you can't legally inherit in particular ways unless you're a male progeny, progeny, and that's how businesses can be maintained within families, then men will appear as the controllers of resources, which they are, but that other people contributing to them is a clear part of the story. And you know, one of the things I've asked is like, how much the Astors are an outlier here. The sort of penultimate was an attempt to say not that much of an outlier. And if you begin to go through like people's letters, a lot of the preserved letters in the New York Historical Society at this time period are letters between husbands and wives asking for advice. And so you see this really pronounced not in the, like in cultural representations, you see this most prominently in the story of John Adams, the second president and very successful new Boston lawyer, who basically Abigail Adams is a key player in the Adams family project of sort of sustaining their position.
Okay, yes, please go ahead.
With the hand up here, yeah.
In the middle of that.
So maybe just pass the mic down. Thank you.
Okay, I was hesitant to, Victoria Grunwald from the LSE. I was hesitant to ask this because I hope no one feels offended by it. But I was very intrigued by you saying, you know, I mean, you kind of asked jokingly, why do these women marry these men?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really interesting to see that the men benefit economically from the marriage, which is something we often ascribe to women, that women marry men for economic reasons, like marry like rich, for example. And I think this is a really, oh, sorry. It should be on, yeah. I think it's a really interesting question in light of like current and probably more like contemporary Western society, where there is research that shows like single women live longer, are happier, and do better. Like there is research that like studies and that do better financially. This might more have to do with like family, having a family or not. But I think this question of like, what does a woman get out of a marriage if we look at it this crudely,
yeah,
is a really contemporary one that I think is really interesting to look at over time.
Yeah,
slightly provocative.
I like it. I mean, so I don't know the research on women's mortality and marriage, you know, so I guess, does the research on like, because there's research that shows that like married people live longer, but is the effect is all driven by men?
Yeah,
yeah, interesting. Gosh, yeah. I wonder how that happens to us gay people. I'm not sure. You know, it also just reminded me that there's this old feminist theory from the 70s. This is just a total aside. It's like women like don't feel love in the way that it's culturally portrayed. Women produce love as an affect to moderate men's insecurities about the fact that women might not be with them other than for the economic exchange. And so within this like affective relation, the way that women like convince men that they're not just in it to like for stability within the family is love. And love gets interpreted as this thing that women feel, but it instead is a thing that women do to alleviate men's anxiety. And I always like loved that theory. I don't think there's any support for it. But it's like another point, right? Like Freud, definitely wrong, but like very compelling. There was a question here. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, I'm Mauricio from the University of Manchester. I think you make a really compelling argument about the importance of taking the families as a unit of study for elite studies. My question would be, wouldn't it be like the same argument just for class generally?
Mm-hmm.
Or what would be so like distinguished or in just looking at the elites?
Yeah, I forget who of us asked this. Was it you, Ashley, today? Like, asked a version of this question in a workshop and was like, what's the difference between making this argument about elites and making this argument about poor people?
Yeah.
Right? So what happens if you pivot the unit of analysis about, say, explanations of poverty to focus on the family and family dynamics versus something else? And I would say like, well, across class, we have someone who's brilliantly like focused on families to help demonstrate the dynamics of class processes and Annette's work. It's, you know, I think, could we say the same about class? Yeah, I mean, and I think, some of what this makes me think about is like, how much of this is a heuristic to help us think more profoundly relationally and to relationally embed individuals in the sets of webs and ties, and how much of it is actually like, so if that's the case, like, could there be other heuristics that you used that would in effect do the same thing? And my response would be like, no, because I can't, at least in the immediate moment, think of a similar social structure, like the, which is what the family is, that is so meaning-laden for people. So if you think about people and their trajectories and their lives, not just as a set of forces that drive them in places, but also are like fundamental to how it is that they construct meaning for themselves and their life in the world, it's hard to imagine one outside of family. That I could think of as a similar sort of heuristic that just embeds relationality into it. So I would say, like, yeah, you could do it for class. It's a very circuitous way of getting to a more direct answer.
Any more questions?
Someone with a mic.
Hi, Per Engzel from UCL.
Your name again?
Per Engzel, UCL.
Yep.
So I think you started out by making the point that women exert influence through family connections without occupying formal positions within organizations.
Mm-hmm.
Broadly correct. And I think that's about that point is well taken, and I think is a point that people have been making for a longer time. So
mm-hmm.
entirely new. And then you brought up Shay O'Brien's work on the Dallas elites and saying that, you know, family networks really matter there, intermarriage and so on, and that's a story about old money. And then you kind of end on this note about these self-made men, and actually, like, a lot of these self-made men were lying on their, or these new men were lying on their wives. And I just wonder, is there something, do you have any thoughts about, like, how gender dynamics or the role of women might matter across those two different settings when you say that many new men rely on their wives? Is that something that's unique for them, or is it actually something that we see, or do women always matter? I mean, I think they do. Right? So what's the point of this distinction between old and new money, if you will? So that's my first question. Maybe I'll just stop there, but I have another question if there's time.
Yeah, so, you know, unfortunately, I don't know enough about Shay's case, like, to deeply talk about the differences in the roles of women across these two places. You know, I will say that across all of these, so that I'll jump forward to a time period that's actually equivalent to Shay's, which is the third set of chapters in the book, that I'll just call it the third chapter for now, deals with Carolyn Astor and the role that she plays in basically orchestrating marriages during the Gilded Age. And central to her practice is to provide a range of, like, opportunities for people. And opportunities for people who are upwardly mobile to, like, still work their way into existing elite networks. And the argument isn't that there aren't, like, upwardly mobile people, that the men are completely reliant on it. I mean, if we just think, like, counterfactually, like, there were several other men who had lived in the Todd household before John Jacob Astor. None of them married Sarah Todd. Like, so there was something about him that made him a compelling person to become, like, a part of this relationship. And he clearly respected the relationship, right? In a way that, like, he understood as being valuable. That's not the case everywhere. And, you know, one of the things that Annette pushed me to think about was, like, this is a very happy story about families. Some families are very unhappy, right? And there's a lot of friction in families, and there's a lot of tensions that happen. And I would say that, like, you know, the account that I've given here and now is sort of a happy account of families, like, all the relations work out and, like, support each other to create a lot of wealth. You know, a different way of coming at part of what you're asking is, like, you know, what are the contexts where, you know, the equivalent of Sarah Todd gets fleeced and abandoned, right? Or what are the contexts where we might think, like, center a different sort of, like, less clean account of, look at all of these things working together. And I think it's like very well taken. I haven't done that yet, and I think it's something I have to do.
Thank you.
So many people now. Emma.
I'm from the University of Oxford, and I have a question. I don't want to be like, I really, you know, it's so good to see someone trying to put in women back into the picture and also marriage. And there seems to be a lot of, I guess, contribution in doing this. But I also had this like thought, like, how is this different than thinking about like the current measures or ways of thinking about intergenerational transmission of status and wealth? Because someone who is really skeptical about this can say that maybe it was Sarah Stodd father who got wealthy, and it's just his wealth transmitted through marriage to this guy, but it's like kind of minimizes the role of that woman and of the marriage. It just says, yeah, that's how generations are created and that's how wealth travels, but it's ultimately still that is, you know, it's the wealth was generated by a man, and it does then I mean it's just generations, and so yeah,
that's great. I mean, so I think in the account, there's like two ways that it's different. And one, I'll point to this being inspired by the work of one of my former doctoral students, Estela Diaz, who's written on preschools in New York City. So she's like finishing up a book on this and has a couple papers. And in that work, she sort of, you know, helps think about children, not just as recipients of status, but as producers of status, right? And so, you know, Stella's really sort of pushing us to think like transmission, it's a very, very linear process in terms of our account. But what if we bring in, as Shay does in the Dallas context, like lateral ties, people on the sides, but also the work that like kids can do and need to do to sustain an enterprise. And so, you know, here that, you know, in the continuation of the John Jacob Astor story, his son, who's the sort of second person along the way, Willem Backhaus Astor, is the second son of the union. And he like leaves New York to go in a very, you know, luxurious European journey where he goes to Germany, he studies with a bunch of German romantics, he like goes to a lecture hall to hear Hegel lecture just after the publication of The Phenomenology of Spirit. Like, he sort of like travels around, but he's called back to New York at one point in time because his older brother, who probably should have been an inheritor, had some kind of either mental disability, mental breakdown, something like that, that like meant that he just, it was made clear that he couldn't actually continue the family project. And like he, you know, the first son gets disappeared somehow. He basically is moved up into an attic and never really heard from again. And Willem comes in and like then does this work to sustain the family. And like he becomes like the critical status worker for this. The children, like the daughters, do similar things. Like in their marriage processes, like one of the things that daughters do is like solidify family position through agreeing to certain kinds of like partnerings. And those partnerings, it's not totally compelled, right? They have, there's some degree of consent, but there you'd think of like children are critical, not just like recipients of things, but actors in the trajectory of families over time. And so I would say like, yeah, it could just be, we could tell this as a story of intergenerational transmission. But I think if we like completely ignore the ways that kids do that work, as Estela argues, or as like, you know, we see across all of these cases, that the things that happen along that way, like it changes the story a little bit. There were a lot of other questions.
Yeah, if we get the back, because I think we're going to the back. Yeah, the back. I will, yeah.
Thanks, Yamuz. I'm Carol from Cambridge. So I completely take this point and this argument also because some of my work is also that women and families. But I just want to say this. I hate it when audience members say, I have a comment or a question, but I'm really sorry, I'm going to do it. which is really that, you know, if you look at any kind of historical analysis of South Asia,
actually families have always been at the center. So in that sense, I like it, but also I'm like, oh, this is something that we've been doing for a long time. And I suppose, of course, an interesting angle of that is caste groups, because it was absolutely impossible to have any kind of businesses with what, well, put it this way, caste groups were associated with professions and therefore also businesses. So family, in some senses, has always been at the center of these elite studies. So just at a meta perspective, going a little above your central argument, I wonder if this is something which is, how would it, the global north finally rising up to the coolness of the south and esteem, so it was just that kind of comment. That,
yeah, I think that's super valuable. I mean, I just think of like, you know, like my dad is from like an extremely rural village in the Punjab, and he is one of many children and one of the only ones who didn't have an arranged marriage, except he did. He just left the country, and his younger brother entered into the marriage, and it was something that as a kid I was kind of embarrassed by, because it's all cross-cousin marriage. So like in my dad's family, it's first cousins marry first cousins. And like when I finally took an anthropology class, I was like, oh. Like I'd grown up in an American context where like this was mortifyingly embarrassing, because like we were obviously so backward. And then I was like, oh. And then it was like this was the way that the family preserved basically the small part of land that they had. Like, and that's how they'd done it for 300 years. And it's my first cousins, not all of them, but still to a degree, are like married to one another. And it was like, it's part of a family strategy. I think, you know, where this comes in is like, I would like point back to, and maybe it's a pretty weak part of the paper right now, but like the Marx and Weber, and be like, you know, transitions to capitalism are about, you know, leaving behind these old non-European places that are engaged in some primitive practice, which is grounded in the family. And we've like moved beyond that with individuals and reason and all this stuff. And to be like, no, that's not actually what the transition of capitalism was really all about. Or it may be part of it, but the dropping of the family piece in that analysis is weak. And then I would say, in a less polite way than you would put it, like maybe you can ease much more, like you don't have to do all of this work if you're just like, hey, let's cite some folks who've made this point in other like transnational, non-global North contexts, and it might be a little bit easier. Yeah.
Elizabeth, have you got it again?
Related to that, what about...
I
was wondering before, and now as you're saying it, both of you, what about the aunties? It's not quite... like the family, but in South Asian culture, the control and power they have, and also when you get kicked out or do something wrong, you need to find something else. And in other kind of historical circumstances, 20th century, maybe also friendship, when friendship from very early on has to be so strong because the whole world is so hostile, you can't trust anybody other than your oldest friends, and then that also being passed over to the next generation by employing your best friend's sons in certain positions, whole network that is created from that. And the last thing, as soon as kind of something came to my mind, the clan type, sub-clan, I don't know, the structures where you also need to look after you've got the responsibility, and that also passes on through generation. There's a thing, switching topics, where so that actually reaches in the past. You didn't talk about the deceased and their role in the present or future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so on the last point, you know, I think it might be useful to, in the paper I make a note, like, I'm talking about the family, not the household. And so there are different ways to measure things. And one would be the household unit. And I'm not interested in the household unit in this talk, or more generally, because I'm like, the relational embedding that I want to do goes far beyond the household. And other examples of you know, questions about the family are about like the clan or clan-based ties, which is sort of thinking about people in a geographic, like, so clans, clan research, you can correct me on this, but, you know, my little entry into this when I was writing this was like, clans are often defined by geographic space. So it's a group of people who occupy a particular geographic space together over some, like, period of time, and which are sort of tied to in subgroups of transform into ethnicities and can if they survive. You know, the way that I want to sort of, no, let me start again. It might be helpful to think about the family or to articulate the family not just as bringing people in, the inclusionary project of bringing in relations, but also like defining people out. That is, the family also as an exclusionary process of saying like, these are the sets of people who cannot become part of our meaningful relational unit. And in that sense, like, there can be people who are proximate but excluded because they can't be affiliated. So here, religion can play a critical role in some exclusive processes of family ties. And there, in the history of the Astor family, their wealth in the second generation generated a series of rumors about Jewishness. They're like, oh, they're secret Jews from Germany. And this was part of a strategy of like trying to exclude them from certain elements of New York society because they were relatively new to it. And it had some impacts on potential marriageability for a period of time. And it also like led me to go like into the record in Germany to see like, was there any truth to this rumor? I mean, going back to the 1500s, so 150 years before Astor's birth was the earliest I could go, and they were Swiss Presbyterians. So it seemed very unlikely that they like had a, like, Swiss Presbyterians are very far from European Jews. And so I would say that like, the thing about the family also is thinking about what are the relational ties, not just of inclusion, but exclusion, which would be very different than thinking in terms of clan dynamics.
Antes?
I don't have anything to say about that.
Can I take care of just ask you to think, thinking through the methodological implications of what you're saying, because as I was hearing you talk, I was reminded of this article by Robert Mayer, you know, when he's after the demography, critiquing the kind of individualistic way in which, you know, mid-20th century social scientists in North America thought about mobility just between individuals and individuals. And of course, the issue there is, you know, quantitative work, particularly when you're doing surveys of individuals, are just they find it very difficult to capture these kind of dynamics you're talking about. So at the very least, you'd have to create much more complex surveys of households and families and things, but arguably you may want to even push it further, so you can't really use survey methods at all to capture these dynamics. I think
I thought about this very thing after, you know, hearing and talking to like David Grusky, who has these sort of dreams of linked data sets that to me are, you know, potential nightmares. Grusky's incredibly like enthusiastic about everything and is just a force of nature, and I deeply love his like it, but he has this dream that he can link, you know, as we have these sort of new sets of techniques, like all kinds of things, even with surveys, discrete surveys, to broader webs of affiliation. Mm-hmm. I would say in the American case, it's extremely unlikely. But I think that there are many other cases where actually we may be able to do this, and then to see, to turn what is a theoretical intervention into an empirical question. Like, does it matter, right? So if we take registry data from a range of contexts and you basically test these propositions, and you ask yourself, is it the case that as we build in this additional set of affiliations into our empirical evaluation, do we get a different answer? And the response could be like, no, we don't. Like, and so I would say with some Danish data, with Dutch data, it's possible to actually turn this into a proposition and to test it, and then to be like, no, this is just a lot of work for nothing. Or, yeah, we did come up with some different kinds of explanations along the way, and it's worthwhile. I don't see that as possible with British data. I don't see it as possible with American data right now. Some people are trying to make it a possibility, but I guess we'll see. I mean, Chetty can do it with his sort of hold on the tax return data. So that's also one possibility.
Annette, our host, you want to come in?
But just to follow up on the, Annette Leroux visiting the LSE, but you would have to have smaller sample sizes, as we were talking about earlier today, don't you think?
I mean, I'm not the person to fully answer this. I mean, I think the technological capacity to do some of this large-scale analysis is there. It's very demanding. I mean, I also think, like, you know, it would require other people who do this kind of work to think through the implications of potential missing data or affiliations that aren't real or misattributed to the power or explanation or the likelihood of like that happening, meaning it's more likely that we get things wrong and so we shouldn't do it that way. And I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, 5 minutes left.
Can you stack some questions?
Do one last round, shall we?
Yeah, feel free to skip me if you feel.
No, please, just
because you speak about the sense of interest and how families maintain the interest over time, and whether you distinguish, I want to ask whether you identified any distinct mechanism of keeping the people recruited in the family, in elite families, because we know that the family as a unit of analysis, as you've said, it could be used in classing analysis in general, but are there distinctive recruitment mechanisms in the elites besides marrying people with more money over time?
Okay, that's one question. Everyone over. Tristan at the back.
Hello, Stephen. Yeah, LSE. And my question would be like, even though you use the name of centering the family in this study, but probably in this lecture you particularly focus on the husband-wife relationship and probably a little bit on the children. I'm not sure if it'd be more fruitful, like you think of put the broader kinship network, like uncle, cousin, uncle of uncle or something like that, to put a broader story into this discussion.
Please, and yeah, the front here.
Yeah, hello, not Andrew in University of Oxford. I was wondering, so in the case of Esther, you showed that for this person, bringing the family into the picture changed the whole story. And if you want to make that claim larger, I was wondering whether this change of perspective would also apply to other members of the family. So whether if you shift it, for instance, to Sarah Todd, the wife, if you have an analysis that's centered on her individual story in comparison to then bringing in the family perspective, whether this would also result in a different narrative of her story. So that might also help you decide whether it's a gender thing or whether it's a larger perspective.
One more, perhaps, if we've got time. Daniela,
thank you. I was just wondering about the more current cases you analyzed and like if you saw any changes in those trajectories and the strategies they used to continue being elite families.
I'll start with the last one, and this actually builds a little bit off the conversation, something Annette raised in the conversation where we were talking about the decisions that people make, and I think this was in relationship to your paper, on family offices. And I was like, well, what about people who give away their money? We noted that like people who give away their money tend not to have their kids, tend not to have kids. Or that there's this could be a trend. And I would note that in the last person that I follow, she maintains the status and augments the status of the family in New York society by giving away all the money. But she has children, but they're not Astor children. They're from a previous marriage, and her marriage into the Astor family produced no future Astor children, which deeply affected the potential control of the money. And so she had actually a really different strategy, and this relates to the second question of how it is that she navigated New York and New York society, in part because there was like no one to give the money to as part of a trust other than part of the British family that there'd been a huge falling out with 70 years earlier that was like never gonna be mended. And so I would note that like, you know, the changes in trajectories in the more current case would be like thinking about how the absence of certain kinds of relational ties produce different strategies or actions by people. And the absence of particular family members is kind of interesting. And this also would point to, in Shay's work, she notes how, and this also returns to your question, like unmarried aunts play really critical roles in helping members not fall. So that like, if one member of the family falls too far, she noted that some of them like weight their inheritance to those people to like lift them back up in order to sustain the kind of like veneer of general familial success. And so you do see those things differently. What does it mean to make this part of a larger story? You know, like what if like I took Sarah Todd? So one of the problems with Sarah Todd is like there's no records of her other than through John Jacob Astor. And like much of the record keeping actually just comes through one primary member of the family. I spent a bit of time thinking about how to deal with this. There's a Jill Lepore, an American historian, who read an entire book about Benjamin Franklin's sister, of which there are no real records. And so she did this like methodological exploration of how you would actually construct a narrative of somebody's life in that way and wrote a book about the person. And it was really fascinating. And I was like, I do not have the historical skill to do that, right? So it sort of went beyond me and my capacity. So I don't know if her entire story would change if I did this for her, because all of her story is mediated through his story. I sort of pointed to the husband-wife, what if we did this with a broader kinship network? I don't do this so successfully in the Astor book. In her capacity of constructing a much broader sort of Dallas web, Shay is able to do this and actually speaks exactly to what you point to, which is sort of nieces, nephews, cousins, aunts, etc., as key players within this. And then to the first question, family and interest over time, distinguish or identify distinct ways to keep recruited people in the family and acting in the consistent way of the family interest. Is that an accurate representation of the first question? Okay. The story that I tell of like a new person coming into the family web is actually pretty rare. Like most in the subsequent thing, most of the people that marry across all generations of people marry roughly equivalent people. So the like problem of disciplining a new person is a relatively rare problem in a family web, because most people have their interests relatively aligned, which is to say they both come from parallel or somewhat similar families. This is not always the case, and actually it makes me think that like I should identify some of the cases where it doesn't happen. So identify where homogamy doesn't fully work. Okay. So I would just say that for the most part, that kind of disciplining doesn't happen as much. And one of the things this will inspire me to do is to go look and see, like, in the marriage webs, what happens under conditions where relatively new people are buying, because it does occasionally happen. You know, there's interesting qualitative work on the tensions in cross-class relationships. So I think of Jesse Stribe's work here and in the United States, and that might give a little bit of guidance, but they're not of the sort of social position in general. So, but thank you for that.
Okay, I hope you finish. But before we give our thanks, let's just also thank Liz.